the date of enactment of this division, the Secretary of the Interior shall reissue the final rule published on April 2, 2009, 74 Federal Regulation 15123 and following, without regard to any other provision of statute or regulation that applies to issuance of such rule. Such reissuance, including this section, shall not be subject to judicial review and shall not abrogate or otherwise have any effect on the order and judgment issued by the United States District Court for the District of Wyoming in case numbers 09CV118J and 09CV138J on November 18, 2010. In plain English, the provision reversed Judge Malloy's ruling, reinstating Fish and Wildlife's decision to delist the wolf in Idaho and Montana, and stipulated that neither Malloy nor any other judge would have the power to overturn Congress's intervention. In Wyoming, meanwhile, the wolf would remain under federal protection, pending the outcome of the state's lawsuit against Fish and Wildlife. The directive, known as a budget rider, had been inserted with the approval of the lead budget negotiators for each side, Harry Reid for the Democrats and John Boehner for the Republicans, just 2 days before the House and Senate voted on the bill. It was authored by Montana Senator John Tester. Tester's rider was unprecedented. It marked the first time in the 38-year history of the Endangered Species Act that Congress had intervened in the rulemaking process to force a desired outcome. With a single paragraph, lawmakers had upended years of jurisprudence based on countless hearings and hundreds of pages of expert testimony. If the move was brazen, it was also cunning. Had the rider's language been in a standalone bill, put to an up or down vote on the Senate floor, its passage would have been extremely unlikely. Pinning it to the coattails of the must-pass budget bill, however, gave Democratic members the cover they needed. They weren't voting against wolves, they were voting for a budget that their leaders had negotiated, a compromise that represented the best possible deal they could get in the face of a Tea Party-dominated Republican caucus that was intent on cutting federal spending to the bone and was willing to hold the federal government hostage to get it done. The rider was Reed's favor to Tester, the boost he needed to climb past Rehberg in the polls. As is often the case with changes slipped in at the 11th hour, there had been no debate on the merits of the rider, nor even any formal announcement of its adoption. Environmental lobbyists caught wind of the move shortly before the scheduled vote, however, and spread the word to liberal bloggers who were outraged. But it was too late. The deal was done, and no 100-word paragraph, no matter how controversial, was going to be allowed to derail a budget agreement months in the making, sealed just hours before a looming government shutdown was set to begin. Tester's rider was just one of a laundry list of policy changes tacked onto the bill, like those governing the fate of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay or low-income women seeking abortions in Washington, D.C., during the backroom negotiation between Reid and Boehner. Wolves had become another commodity in Capitol Hill's never-ending swap meet. Judge Malloy was equally powerless to undo the maneuver, as he conceded in a short ruling that seethed with unconcealed anger. Congress's action represented a tearing away, an undermining, and a disrespect for the fundamental idea of the rule of law, he wrote. And yet his hands were tied. The rider sacrifices the spirit of the Endangered Species Act to appease a vocal political faction, he wrote, but the wisdom of that choice is not now before this court. The only question was whether the rider was constitutional, and Malloy had to concede that it was. The rule was reinstated, and wolves were no longer protected in Montana and Idaho. The great victory that wolf advocates had won in Malloy's court the previous summer had lasted less than a year. State officials in Idaho and Montana were exultant. 4 days after Tester's rider became law, Governor Otter signed a bill declaring gray wolves a disaster emergency in Idaho and authorizing state officials to take immediate action to reduce their numbers. It played well with anti-wolf forces, though state officials quietly conceded that they were content with waiting for the regular fall season to renew hunting in the state. Montana would do the same. Things will be better tomorrow. That was the credo wolves lived by, Rick had long ago decided. Regardless of the hardship and misadventure that every pack inevitably faced, they were essentially optimists. He tried to see life that way too, but it wasn't easy. In the weeks that followed, he found himself fielding questions from visitors about wolf hunting around the park, and he answered as best he could, with the studied neutrality he'd learned to adopt as an employee of the National Park Service. The federal government officially supported delisting of wolves, after all, and good relations with game managers in states adjacent to the park were essential. During Montana's 2009 hunt, Doug Smith had made some mild comments to reporters about the setback to his research caused by the death of collared wolves, prompting a personal rebuke from the park superintendent. The two weren't always on the best of terms, despite the project's success and popularity with visitors. "Why does the wolf project stick out like a sore thumb?" Smith's boss had once asked. This time, Smith's reaction was pragmatic. Another hunting season along the park's northern and western borders was only 5 months away, and he was determined to limit the damage. He met with Montana wildlife officials to discuss limiting the take in hunting zones adjoining the park, especially around Jardine, where so many park wolves had been lost in 2009. Still, it was inevitable that some Yellowstone wolves would be killed. Rick thought of the jaunt through Silvergate that the Lamars had taken back in October. National forest land lined both sides of the road through town and up to Cook City and beyond, and the woods were full of hunters during elk season. If 06 were to lead her charges on the same excursion this fall, one of Rick's neighbors could step outside his home and shoot her in his front yard. Silvergate was definitely a wolf-friendly town. But you never knew. Lori sometimes heard old-timers muttering about all the watchers, wolf groupies, they called them, in the local motels. Tester's rider was all anybody in Crandall talked about for days afterward. Congress had finally done something sensible about wolves. Of course, it didn't change the local situation in the slightest, since Wyoming still had no wolf hunting season. Turnbull supposed he could head up into Montana and get a permit to shoot one, but he wouldn't even know where to begin to look. The country he knew was in Crandall, as were the wolves that needed shooting. Turnbull hadn't seen too many signs of them in recent months, though he'd been out in the woods as much as he could, collecting shed elk antlers, as he did every year, and keeping an eye out for the best-looking black bear he could find, the one he'd be taking that season. Crandall hadn't really had a resident wolf pack since government hunters eliminated the local wolves almost entirely in the summer of 2008. They had done the same thing to a pack denning in nearby Sunlight in 2010 after a rancher there lost some cattle, and now only a pair of wolves were left in that basin. The word was that they weren't denning, so there'd be no pups that spring. Still, Turnbull knew there were wolves around. Louis Carey usually kept pretty good tabs on what was happening on the other side of the mountains in the Lamar Valley, and he kept everyone in Crandall up to date on which Yellowstone wolves he'd seen coming and going. It seemed a new pack was denning in Lamar, and they were coming east from time to time, as park wolves tended to do. In fact, Turnbull had a friend at a bar in Cook City, where he went for beer and barbecue almost every Sunday, who had spotted a pack that spring walking right down the road from Silvergate. He thought he'd heard a howl or two himself recently, coming maybe from Hunter Peak, behind Louis's place. Calf survival in Yellowstone's northern herd had been dismal again that spring, which meant another lean fall was coming for elk hunters all around the park. Turnbull wasn't sure who represented Wyoming in the U.S. Senate, but he was starting to wonder what exactly it was they did for a living. If John Tester could do what he did for Montana, then why couldn't Wyoming senators do the same thing? When Doug Smith and Roger Stradley, the park's longtime pilot, flew over Yellowstone's mountains and valleys, Smith didn't always look for wolves. Sometimes he counted beavers. Once a year, he and a handful of other researchers flew over almost the entire park to make note of beaver food caches, piles of wood big enough to be spotted from the air, each of which signified the presence of a beaver colony. Not long after wolf reintroduction, Smith noticed that he was finding more and more colonies. From just 49 in 1996, the number had ballooned to 118 by 2009. The increase was partly due to a reintroduction of beavers that had taken place just north of the park in the mid-1990s, but that didn't explain why the animals had found Yellowstone streams so hospitable after decades of absence. The answer seemed to be a resurgence of willow, the riparian shrub that is the beaver's preferred food. And why was the willow coming back? Smith was still trying to figure that out, but he knew the answer almost certainly had something to do with wolves. As their numbers grew after reintroduction, elk numbers had, of course, declined. But just as important, their behavior had changed as well. No longer free to congregate at their leisure along stream banks, elk were spending less time browsing on willow, which left plenty for the beavers. More wolves, it seemed, meant more beavers, but that wasn't all. The return of Yellowstone's top predator was having repercussions up and down the park's food chain. The Lamar Valley that '06 claimed as her own was not the same landscape that her Druid ancestors had been introduced to 15 years before. It was healthier in ways that even some of the wolf's most ardent advocates hadn't anticipated. Biologists called this type of chain reaction a trophic cascade, and by the spring of 2011, ironically just as the political situation was turning sour for wolves, it was the hottest research subject in the park, not only for Smith's own colleagues at the Wolf Project, but also for visiting biologists from around the country. At a time when species were disappearing from the earth at a rate faster than that of any period since the extinction of the dinosaurs, here was a rare success story. Greater Yellowstone, the largest intact temperate ecosystem left in the world, was returning to its former glory. Smith happily greeted every visitor and kept tabs on every study, proud to be at the center of so much intellectual ferment. One of the most dramatic changes concerned coyotes. Yellowstone had long hosted one of the densest coyote populations in North America, but that quickly changed with the reintroduction of wolves. After decades as Yellowstone's top canines, the park's coyotes seemed to have lost their collective memory of how to coexist with their much larger relatives. They routinely approached wolves feeding on carcasses, as was their habit when they spotted an easy meal. Time and again, wolf watchers observed coyotes realizing their fatal mistake far too late, as the faster and more powerful wolves easily ran them down and killed them. Wolves colonizing new areas of the park routinely dug up and destroyed coyote dens, killing any pups they found, to eliminate competition for prey and to make their own dens safer. In short order, Yellowstone's newly dominant canines reduced the northern range's coyote population by half. What happened next was revelatory. The park's rodent population, long depressed by years of unchecked predation by ever-present coyotes, rebounded immediately. This meant a sudden increase in the food supply for raptors like owls and hawks. Healthier birds began having larger broods, and Yellowstone's birdwatching community began seeing an avian renaissance, something they never realized they were missing. Weasels and foxes also benefited from the rebounding rodent population, and their numbers began to grow too. Even pronghorn numbers were up. Though no predator in North America can run down a healthy adult pronghorn, Coyotes routinely fed on helpless newborn calves, which had long depressed the park's herds. Wolves, however, seldom take pronghorn calves, so their displacing of coyotes meant more antelope survived to adulthood. Another surprise for Smith and his colleagues was the sheer number of animals that fed on wolf kills. Not only ravens and magpies, but also coyotes, foxes, and eagles routinely visited almost every carcass, despite wolves' efforts to keep them away. Smith began calling the phenomenon food for the masses, and the Wolf Project biologists Dan and Aaron Stoller, a husband and wife team, began turning out paper after paper on the phenomenon. Wolf kills were also a major new source of nutrition for the park's bears, and it turned out a very timely one. Wolf reintroduction coincided with a steady decline in the production of white bark pine nuts in the park, a key source of protein for bears. They routinely raided nut caches created by the park's squirrels in the fall, the season when bears were preparing for hibernation and needed to feed as much as possible. Climate change was considered the most likely cause for the decline, and researchers expected to see less healthy bears and fewer cubs as a result. Yet the bears seemed to still be thriving, possibly, researchers theorized, because elk carcasses brought down by wolves were offsetting the loss of the nuts. New research on declining elk numbers brought unexpected results as well. Each year, state game managers tabulated the number of elk taken by hunters, the harvest as it was known. The northern Yellowstone herd had declined dramatically, limiting the harvest in a few areas immediately adjacent to the park. But statewide, elk harvests hadn't dipped at all in Wyoming, Montana, or Idaho. In fact, they were trending up. In 2010, for example, Wyoming hunters took 25,420 elk, a new record for the state and a 30% jump from 1995, the year wolves were first reintroduced. Even more promising, from Smith's perspective, was a new study by the young biologist Arthur Middleton, who set out to measure elk-calf survival rates in the region east of the park. Wolf critics, especially the Wyoming Farm Bureau, were acutely interested in Middleton's study, correctly anticipating that he would report the numbers to be at almost historic lows. But they were somewhat less enthusiastic about the findings from the second phase of Middleton's project, his assessment of what was causing the decline. After months of observing elk interact with predators, he concluded that grizzlies, not wolves, had taken the majority of the calves, and that most elk in the region rarely encountered a wolf at all. He also concluded that stress caused by drought, not wolves, was the main driver of low pregnancy rates among cows, which further depressed herd numbers. The science was on Smith's side, but it didn't seem to matter to ranchers and hunters or to state legislators. The debate wasn't about science anymore, if indeed it ever had been. By mid-April, 06 had disappeared altogether, and Rick knew that a new litter had been born. The watchers set up camp across the road from the base of Druid Peak in a large parking lot known informally as Hitching Post, since guided horse trips into the Lamar Valley often left from the spot. News that the den was once again in use traveled fast, and Hitching Post, along with a pair of adjacent pullouts, filled up quickly every morning, as 100 or so people set up shop to wait for the Lamar wolves to make an appearance. With the yearlings now joining in the hunt, the den was well provisioned and well protected. Though hidden from view, it was not far from the road, and wolves bringing food home crossed the blacktop so frequently that rangers were obliged to put up signs prohibiting stopping along a stretch near the base of the mountain to prevent endless traffic jams caused by wolf sightings. There was a particular spot where the Druids had always crossed, a narrow gully now immortalized as 21's Crossing, and the Lamars instinctively used it as well, drawn to the cover it provided right up until the unavoidable dash across the blacktop. On June 21st, the watchers finally got their first view of the new pups, in a meadow a short hop east of the Den Forest. This time there were five, three blacks and two grays, all healthy and eager to explore. In the weeks that followed, Hitching Post was more packed than ever. Watchers were deterred only slightly by the washout of the park road a few days after the first sighting, as Soda Butte Creek jumped its banks just upstream from the parking lot. As the days warmed up, the park's unusually heavy snowpack led to enormous runoff, and every stream in the park had become a gushing torrent of ice-cold snowmelt. The Lamars were now 12 members strong, and the constant coming and going from the Den Forest meant there was always something for the watchers to see. Although it took a good while, and countless observations of urinations and comparing of notes, the watchers eventually determined that both gray pups and two of the three blacks were females. Along with the two female yearlings, the family had become female-heavy, which meant that sooner or later 755 would be dealing with suitors from other packs. It was beginning to look like he might be doing so without his brother. 754 was spending more and more time alone, which wasn't uncommon in summer when the pack was at its least cohesive. The new litter of pups kept the alphas relatively immobile, leaving subordinate wolves largely to their own devices. Hunting was happening singly, or in parties of twos and threes for the most part, yet the den was still the axis of each pack member's orbit, and 754 was returning to check in less and less often. In his absence, Shy Male had stepped into the favored caregiver role for the new litter of pups. He shared his uncle's gentle nature, along with the boundless reserves of patience the job required. 754 also seemed reluctant to come in to feed on kills when other pack members were present. He was leery of 06 in particular, who had begun forcing the brothers to wait to eat, snarling and snapping at them until she had filled her belly with meat for the pups. When she was in this state, 754 didn't even bother groveling, though that was always his first instinct. Instead, he would sometimes appeal to his brother, as though 755 might somehow hold the key to getting the pair a spot at the table. But 755 had learned to simply wait until she was gone. When he got too close on one such occasion, she'd seized his lip between her teeth and given a vicious shake, and he didn't need a repeat lesson. If it meant the brothers seldom got the choicest bits, the heart and other organs, for example, that was just the way it had to be. One morning, 754 tagged along with a hunting party consisting of 06, 755, and Dark Gray Male as they tested a herd of perhaps 200 elk above Slough Creek, not far from the old den site. With four yearlings and five pups, the pack now had a lot of mouths to feed, and kills were becoming fewer and farther between as midsummer in the valley pushed the elk up into higher elevations, where it was cooler and the forage was better. The prey that remained were approaching their physical peak, well fed on the valley's abundance. 754 watched from a distance as the threesome approached the herd from below and the elk closed ranks. 06 drove into the milling mass, trying to split them apart. But there were too many, and instead of marshaling her quarry, she succeeded only in creating chaos. She found herself fleeing east across the mountainside with a bold cow in pursuit, only to be caught beneath the hooves of a large group of elk bolting heedlessly in the opposite direction. She was rolled like a dog between the wheels of a pickup, but leaped up unscathed. The elk regrouped, and the hunters came away with nothing. As his packmates considered their options, 754 maintained his distance. Not long ago, he would have been running alongside his brother and 06. Now that the yearlings were becoming accomplished hunters, his presence wasn't so important. He was still the pack's beta male, which meant that 06, long the object of his desire, would become his mate if something were to happen to 755. But it had now been 18 months since she chose 755 instead of him, and though he still showered her with all the affection she would tolerate, It was clear that he would have to leave home if he was going to find a mate of his own. Rick had grown so accustomed to seeing the three adults together, it was hard to imagine what the pack would be like without 754. It had only been a few seasons, but it seemed like much longer. The brothers just seemed of a piece with each other, 754's goofy antics complementing his brother's workmanlike demeanor. If 754 did leave the pack, nobody would miss him more than Doug McLaughlin. 754 had become his favorite wolf. Every watcher had one, just as a teacher always has a favorite student, or a parent, secretly, a child. To Doug, there was something tragic about 754, his gentleness in spite of his great size, his boundless loyalty to his dominant brother, somehow untainted by his hopeless pursuit of his brother's mate. His continued presence in the pack had always been at the whim of his brother, and every gesture 754 made seemed to be an apology, every decision colored by the endless drive to seek approval. If 754 left the valley, the watchers could still track his caller's signal, but he might relocate somewhere remote where sightings were virtually impossible, or he might not survive the effort at all. That summer, Wyoming's hunters finally got the news they had been waiting years to hear. On July 7th, Interior Secretary Salazar met with Matt Meade, Wyoming's newly elected governor, at the state capitol in Cheyenne. With Salazar was Dan Ash, whom President Obama had just appointed his new Fish and Wildlife Director. They hadn't made the long journey from Washington by choice. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso had demanded the meeting as a condition of Ash's confirmation by the Senate, where by long-standing tradition, even a single member can hold up a presidential appointment indefinitely at his or her own discretion. Barrasso, a Republican from Casper, wanted a deal made to get wolves delisted in Wyoming once and for all, and he wanted it done now. 7 days after Ash was confirmed, he was on a plane to Cheyenne. The next day, Governor Meade announced that the two sides had reached a tentative agreement. Wyoming's recalcitrance seemed to have paid off in the end. Despite lengthy negotiations over the preceding year, state officials had made scarcely any concessions. Under the proposed management plan, almost the entire state, everything south and east of the Yellowstone to Grand Teton National Park corridor, was still a predator zone, in which wolves could be killed at any time for any reason. Back in 2009, this had been a deal-killer for Fish and Wildlife, yet now the department reversed itself and signed off on the arrangement under the somewhat circular logic that an almost total lack of wolves in the eastern four-fifths of the state meant that it wasn't critical wolf habitat. The same could have been said for Yellowstone National Park prior to 1995. In fact, by the agency's own count, there were 46 wolves currently living in what would become the predator zone, including three breeding pairs. Under the terms of the agreement, it was assumed that all these wolves would be killed in relatively short order once the delisting order was approved. Likewise, the state's plan still lacked any firm commitment to maintain a buffer above the absolute minimum of 100 wolves outside Yellowstone. But that didn't seem to matter anymore either. If it was becoming abundantly clear to wolf advocates just how few friends they had left in Washington, officials at Fish and Wildlife were just as capable of reading the tea leaves. The fight over wolves was moving from the courts to the political arena, and it was a war the wolves were losing. No firm deal had yet been made, so there was no timetable for Wyoming's first wolf hunt. It wouldn't happen that fall, which was fast approaching. Still, Crandall's remaining outfitters began exploring the idea of adding a wolf hunt to their menu of services. It was starting to seem like the feds really meant it this time. On August 19th, Doug spotted 754 bedded with his brother in the heather not far from Soda Butte Creek. Eventually he stood, and after rousing 755 with a submissive lick, began heading east. Through his scope, Doug could immediately tell something was wrong with the way 754 was moving. His front left leg was broken. He had apparently injured it the night before, most likely during a hunt. The leg wouldn't hold any weight at all, which meant that 754 could barely manage more than a trot. A broken leg was the most common injury for wolves, and next to a wounded jaw, the most worrisome. For a lone wolf, it was often a death sentence. A few days later, a watcher spotted 754 far up the Soda Butte Creek drainage, limping alone through Round Prairie with four coyotes tailing him relentlessly. So formidable on four legs, a wolf with only three is a humble creature. The huge black wolf was three times the size of any of his pursuers, but in his reduced state, he could only tuck his tail and plod along, ears flat and head low, until he reached the woods. Had those coyotes in Round Prairie been strange wolves instead, 754 would easily have been killed. Over the next 6 weeks, as his leg slowly healed, 754 returned to the fold, never straying far from his brother and 06, and feeding off the pack's kills as he always had. Even with nothing to contribute, he was as welcome as he had ever been, though elk were now becoming truly scarce. Between kills, the wolves were reduced to gnawing on the dusty, suntanned hides and scattered bones of winter-killed bison that had died months before. In one respect, the timing of the injury was fortunate. Had the break occurred in winter, when the pack was fully mobile and wandering the length and breadth of its territory, 754 would have been hard-pressed to keep up. He hopped along as best he could at his brother's side, plopping down for a rest at every opportunity. Even so, he found himself left behind from time to time, especially when the pack crossed the road. The blacktop was more intimidating than ever, now that he couldn't dart across. He was so flustered one evening that Rick had to stop traffic for him so that he could join the rest of the pack, heading up Druid Peak to the den. In the end, it was not 754 who left the pack that summer, but Dark Gray. He'd been turning up in the Watcher's scopes less frequently since early August. By the first week in September, he was gone. It wasn't surprising that he was the first to strike out on his own. Even as a pup, he had stood out for his boldness. Still, the Watchers missed him. Especially Lori. She could still remember him tumbling down off the narrow landing in front of the den above Slough Creek and being dragged back up in his mother's jaws. Wolf generations were so short. Just when you got to know one litter of pups, some of them would inevitably disappear and another group was on the way. Without a collar on Dark Gray, the Watchers would likely never know what the future held for him, or where in Greater Yellowstone he would end up. He might become an alpha and sire generations of pups of his own, or he might be killed the moment he left the Lamar Valley. Rick liked his chances. If nothing else, he was an outstanding hunter, having learned from the best. On August 30th, 2011, the wolf hunting season opened in Idaho. Montana's would follow 2 weeks later. Montana set a statewide quota of 220 wolves, but Idaho set no upper limit, the goal still being to drive wolf numbers as low as legally permitted. What might have been a gloomy day in the park became full of excitement as 06 finally moved the pups out of the den forest and onto the valley floor, to a spot she had chosen near the base of Mount Norris, about 2 miles east of the old Druid summer rendezvous. Always a traumatic event for pups born on Druid Peak, the move down off the mountain began smoothly enough. After months of high water, Soda Butte Creek had finally returned to normal flow, and the pups crossed without incident. Set up on a hill at the base of Druid Peak, the watchers could see the family moving through an early morning fog in the valley, south toward the river corridor. The pups were awed by the new surroundings, by turns cowering and running excitedly ahead. The yearlings helped 06 herd them south toward the rendezvous, chasing the pups down when they occasionally made a break for the mountain and home. Just as the family reached the river, two visitors on horseback, riding a trail through the valley, spotted them and began to approach. At the sight of the horses, 755 panicked and fled east, with 754 limping along behind as best he could. 06 made for the trees on the far side of the valley, with two of the pups in tow. The remaining three were still in the river corridor, but the curious riders decided to follow 06, and she couldn't turn around until she reached the trees. Over the next hour, the watchers looked on apprehensively as 06 methodically searched for the three missing pups, howling periodically and pausing to listen for their replies. By the end of the evening, she had found only two. Lori feared the worst, but 2 days later, all five were sighted in the rendezvous. Just after dawn on September 20th, Lori spotted a pair of female agates not far from Junction Butte in Little America, moving north across a frost-covered plain toward the ford in the Lamar River. She had been following the progress of the two wolves, one of whom was 06's younger sister, for months as they tried to form a new pack. Hearing a howl, Lori scanned the landscape until she spotted a slender gray bedded in the sage, calling after the two females. To her delight, it looked very much like dark gray, the missing Lamar yearling. If she was right, it meant he hadn't gone far after all, and he seemed to have found a home, or at least a decent prospect. By late September, the Lamars were beginning to go on longer jaunts from the rendezvous with the pups in tow. They were big enough now that it was sometimes difficult to tell them from the yearlings, and when all 11 members set out together, they were a force to behold. One evening, Rick watched as the pack boldly drove off a grizzly that had tried to take over a kill the wolves had made near the river the night before. 776 was emerging as the beta female, frequently taking the lead position as the pack moved across the valley floor and joining her mother in the vanguard of hunting forays. Like her mother, she showed no fear of the road. She was clearly an alpha in the making, and wasn't shy about dominating her sister, Middle Gray, when she felt it was necessary. Now that 754 was back in the fold, Shy Male had resumed his habit of shadowing him, never missing an opportunity to submit to his uncle. The pups, meanwhile, were flourishing. One of them, the light gray female, had become a favorite of the watchers. Her very light coat, almost white in the summer, made her easy to recognize, but it was her beautiful facial markings that truly set her apart. Her face was almost two-toned, white on the cheeks and gray through the nose and eyes, which were unusually expressive. Aside from their traumatic move to the rendezvous, the new litter seemed almost charmed. They had little trouble from bears. Lori even watched the pups play with a young grizzly, perhaps 2 years old, who had just left his mother and was still adapting to life on his own. For a half hour, the pups chased him playfully as he spun and bluff-charged this way and that, never making an aggressive move and seemingly enjoying every moment. Days later, the pups experienced their first real snow, gleefully sliding down embankments and rolling on top of one another. So often in summer, packs tended to drift apart, in Rick's experience, with yearlings that seemed to come and go, neither fully committed to the pack nor completely independent of it. Or there would be succession struggles as subordinate adults bucked against the alpha's leadership. But the Lamars were unusually cohesive. 06's powerful presence, the pole around which the rest of the pack orbited. Despite Rick's pleasant mornings in the park with the Lamars, it was impossible not to think about the hunt when he returned to Silvergate in the evenings. The woods were full of elk hunters, and he frequently heard gunshots as he sat in his cabin, typing up his notes or eating his bison spaghetti. Every time a wolf was spotted in the back of a truck in Gardner, Rick would hear the report. The first legal trapping season in decades would soon begin in Idaho. October 5th brought more bad news. Fish and Wildlife had officially endorsed the Wyoming delisting plan announced back in the summer. As expected, the state's management plan for wolves was essentially the same document that Fish and Wildlife had rejected 3 years before. The plan was sent out to experts for a lengthy peer review process, with the tentative goal of turning management over to the state in time for a hunting season in the fall of 2012, which was roughly 14 months away. If it came to pass, Yellowstone would essentially be surrounded by wolf hunting zones, and no wolf foraying out of the park in any direction would be safe. For the watchers, a kind of siege mentality set in. Lori had always been sensitive about the dirty looks she sometimes received from locals passing through the park when she was on the side of the road with her scope. Now it seemed to her that it was happening more often. "Get a good look," a man in a passing pickup told her. "They won't be there much longer." The scowls always seemed to come from drivers with Wyoming plates. She imagined them heading down into Crandall, where so many Yellowstone wolves had been lost over the years, and waiting for their chance to shoot another, legally this time. Shortly after Fish and Wildlife's announcement, the Wolf Project recorded the season's first confirmed losses to the hunt. Both of the former agates that Lori had spotted traveling with the Lamar yearling Dark Gray had been shot north of the park. There was no way of knowing whether Dark Gray had been with them at the time, and his whereabouts were unknown. Project staff spotted a female yearling, the last known living member of the ill-fated pack, traveling far and wide in the months after the death of her companions. She was alone. Thanks to Doug Smith's efforts, the quota for the hunting zone just north of the park had been reduced from 12 in 2009 to just 3, and the two Yellowstone wolves were the second and third taken, closing the area for the season. That should have meant no more Northern Range wolves were in danger, at least until fall came around again. Nevertheless, the park lost one more when a hunter illegally shot a wolf known as 692 near Jardine on November 5, 2011. She was a 5-year-old female, well known to the watchers as one of the founding alphas of the Blacktail Pack, though she had been wandering more or less on her own for some time. She had been born an agate in the same litter as 06. The hunter, a local, told authorities he was unaware the limit had been reached in the area, though it had been closed for a full month. He was fined $135. Chapter 10 Rampage of the Mollies. On a clear morning that fall, Aaron Stoller flew over the Pelican Valley in Roger Stradley's Piper Cub, looking for the Mollies pack. Known for its brutal weather and dense grizzly population, the Pelican wasn't ideal wolf habitat, but then the Mollies had not come there by choice. The high, snowy valley in the park's interior was where the pack's original alpha female, driven from the Lamar Valley by the Druids 15 years before, had finally stopped running. The Pelican had few elk in winter, but the original Mollies taught themselves to prey on bison, and their descendants remained the only pack in the park that did so regularly. They seldom got to enjoy their meals as they would have wished, however. The Mollies lost most of their carcasses after an hour or two to the Pelican Valley's ubiquitous grizzlies, which could smell a fresh kill from miles away. Still, the pack endured. Theirs was a story of perseverance, and Stoller, like Doug Smith and the rest of the team, had come to admire those original pioneering wolves and their descendants. Now that the Druids were no more, the Mollies had officially become the last of the original handful of packs brought down from Canada. In Stradley's capable hands, the tiny plane swept the windy, craggy terrain as methodically as a crop duster working a wheat field, while Stoller scanned through the pack's frequencies on her receiver. Eventually, she spotted the alpha female, 486, in the southwestern part of the valley, traveling alone. In the Pelican's upper reaches, Stoller found what seemed to be the rest of the pack. She counted 9 adults sleeping in the snow, along with 7 pups. The Mali Alpha male, 495, was not among them. After another pass, Stoller found out why. Her receiver picked up 495's collar transmitting in mortality mode. Discoveries like this were why project biologists flew the park so often. Outside the Lamar Valley, it was impossible to know what was going on with most of the packs without a plane, and this was a major development. Though just how big, Stoller didn't yet realize. A few days later, a crew hiked in to investigate and found 495's carcass in the snow. He had suffered traumatic injuries, most likely from a bison kick. Even past his prime at 9 years of age, 495 was an amazing specimen. At the time of his collaring in 2005, he weighed 143 pounds, making him one of the largest Yellowstone wolves on record. With his dark coat and massive head, he resembled a juvenile black bear lumbering across the snow. Many of his male offspring had grown up to be almost as formidable as their father. He had been the pack's alpha male for a little over 2 years, and his reign had been a productive one. With 5 adults, 7 yearlings, and 7 pups, the pack was flourishing. Now, however, the longtime Mali alpha female, 486, would have to find a new mate, most likely from outside the pack, since most of the subordinate males were related to her. Ordinarily, a dispersing male from another pack would fill that position, but a large pack could intimidate would-be suitors, and the pelican was so remote that lone wolves seldom wandered through. In the end, 486 decided to leave the pack to seek a mate on her own. The problem was that it was almost time for the Mali's annual journey out of the valley, the time when the pack needed leadership the most. Elk tended to leave the pelican early in winter when the snows got too deep. Bison were a viable, if much more difficult, alternative, but the pack had also formed the habit of coming north to the Lamar Valley, revisiting the same rich hunting grounds the Druids had wrested from them so long ago. Over the years, the watchers had learned to expect some conflict, like the ambush that claimed the life of 42 in 2004. Yet the Mollies rarely stayed long. They were after elk, not territory. Within a few weeks, they usually returned home to the pelican, not to be seen again until the following year. But this winter, things were different. When the Mollies left home, they were 19 wolves strong, less a pack than an army, but one that was in considerable disarray. A subordinate female had stepped into 486's place, but there was no new candidate to take over for the dead alpha male. The result was mayhem on a scale not seen since the Wolf Project began. On December 2nd, the Mollies killed the alpha male of the Merry Mountain pack in the Hayden Valley, an area along the Yellowstone River west of the pelican. From there, the pack moved north, engaging 06's natal pack, the Agates, in a series of skirmishes. On December 22nd, Doug Smith detected a mortality code from Agate 775, the alpha male. Nobody had witnessed the conflicts, but Smith wasn't surprised that 2 alphas were among the casualties. They tended to do the heavy fighting when packs collided. The trail of destruction made it clear enough where the Mollies were headed, and it was only a matter of time before they arrived. On January 6th, Rick and Lori were in a pullout near the midpoint in the Lamar Valley when they spotted the Lamars bedded on a bald knob near the top of Specimen Ridge. Suddenly, the wolves were up and moving in unison to the east. Rick scanned in the opposite direction and saw the reason. The Mollies were coming over Specimen a mile to the west, all 19 of them. 06 drove her family along the side of the ridge, determined to put several miles between herself and the invading pack. The Mollies began scent trailing, following their noses down to a meadow where the Lamars had bedded the day before. They milled about like army ants, inhaling every trace of the resident pack's presence, parsing what intelligence they could gather about O6 and her considerable brood. They were undeterred by what they learned, pushing farther east along the Lamar's trail, giving up only when it became clear that the pack was by now miles away. A week later, Rick saw firsthand what happened when a pack didn't flee, or at least not fast enough. Just east of Lamar Canyon, a group of 9 Mollies chasing elk through the trees came upon a quartet of blacktail wolves that had ventured out of their own territory, most likely pursuing elk as well. Curious about the oncoming wolves, the blacktails hesitated, and the Mollies overtook them not far from the road. 3 of the 4 blacktails ran wildly for home after the skirmish, but the next morning the body of a 4-year-old male was found on the frozen Lamar River, not far from the bank. He'd recently injured a leg, no doubt making him the slowest among his comrades, and the first to be run down. In the update she sent out that night, January 4, 2012, Lori gave him her customary obituary, a task she'd found herself doing with disturbing regularity since the Mollies first left the Pelican some 5 weeks earlier. She tried to be diplomatic about it. The Mollies were just doing what came naturally to wolves, she pointed out. But the truth was, she dreaded their inevitable clash with the Lamars as much as everybody else in Yellowstone's wolf-watching community. On February 4th, O6 was finally collared. Doug Smith hadn't meant to dart her. When he came across the pack flying over Jasper Bench, he'd thought he was targeting 776, the 2-year-old gray female who'd lost her collar and needed a new one. The mother and daughter were difficult to tell apart, especially from the helicopter, with the snow swirling below the blades. When he landed and examined the gray lying in the snow, however, he was surprised to find a bit of blood in her vulva, a sign the wolf was in proestrus, a hallmark of the breeding female. Was he about to collar 06? It could have been 776. She was just old enough to breed. The truth was he couldn't be sure which wolf he'd brought down. He hadn't spent hours watching the pack through a scope, as Rick had. He returned to the chopper and radioed Rick, who was watching from the road. "I think I've got the old lady instead," he said, using his term for an alpha female. But despite the distance and the chaos caused by the chopper's appearance above the pack, Rick was certain he'd seen 06 head into the woods before Smith had taken the shot. Lori, who was standing beside him, felt the same. It had to be 776. Smith trudged back through the snow and looked at the gray again. She was in remarkable shape. No broken or worn teeth, her muscle tone excellent. She weighed 97 pounds. Convinced he had the daughter, not the mom, he fitted her with the improved collar the project had begun using, a state-of-the-art $4,000 device that could be tracked not only by radio telemetry in the field, but also by GPS from a desk in the Wolf Project's offices. Then he loaded her into the chopper and ferried her across the valley to a secluded spot on the northern side, far from the Mollies' last known location, where she could safely recover from the effects of the tranquilizer. By the following evening, the mistake was plain. At the first good sighting of the pack, Rick could clearly see that Smith had collared 06, not 776. He was chagrined, and Lori was beside herself. She was their favorite wolf, the one they had watched more than any other for the last 2 years. How could they have been so wrong? Smith had told himself the gray in his sights couldn't be 06, he later confided in Rick, because 06 would have immediately run for the trees, and he wouldn't have been able to get her. Rick supposed that subconsciously he had felt the same way, that 06 would never allow herself to be caught. She was too clever. Her official number was now 832, though she would always be 06 to the watchers. That same week, Smith also collared the light gray female pup, the one the watchers had singled out for her unusual beauty. She was now known as 820. Both wolves recovered well and returned immediately to the pack. A few days after the collaring operation, Lori was standing behind her scope in the parking lot at the Slough Creek turnoff, scanning the hillside south of the park road. It was mid-morning, about 20 degrees, and an inch of new snow lay on the ground from the night before. She could hear the Lamars howling. The pack was somewhere in the trees on a shoulder jutting north from Specimen Ridge. The watchers called the area Divide Ridge because it stood between Little America to the west and the Lamar Valley to the east. It was a spot rich in wolf history. One of the acclimation pens had been built near the base of the ridge in a drainage known as Crystal Creek. It was surprisingly close to the road, roughly 400 yards from where Lori now stood. Eventually, she spotted the Lamars. All 11 of them had moved into an open area not far from where the pen once stood. They seemed to be howling at something above them on Specimen Ridge. Rick, just down the road in the next pullout, had radioed earlier that the Mollies were in the area chasing a coyote, though Lori hadn't yet seen them from her vantage point. Another watcher stood next to Lori, a wildlife photographer named Peter Murray, who had recently moved to the area and was now spending all his free time following the wolves. He scanned the skyline at the top of Specimen, looking for whatever it was that had set the Lamars off. "Holy shit," he blurted. Lori pulled away from her eyepiece and followed Murray's alarmed gaze. 10 wolves were coming down Specimen, stretched out in a long line parallel to the horizon, like a cordon of sheriff's deputies searching the woods for a lost child. The Mollies had found 06 at last. They paused perhaps a quarter mile above the Lamars, who had now fallen silent, and waited. Lori wanted to yell, "Run!" Instead, she radioed Rick, lowering her voice to a whisper because the Lamars were so close. Rick had already spotted the two packs squaring off. There was nothing Lori could do but sign off and hold her breath, as 06 and the rest of the pack paced back and forth excitedly. By now the Mollies had been roaming the northern range for over 40 days. In that time they had killed 4 wolves that the watchers knew of. The blacktail they had slain had been caught on the very ridge where the Lamars were now trapped. If the Lamars ran now, they might still escape unharmed. On the other hand, only 10 of the 19 Mollies were present, and among the missing was the wolf that seemed to have become the new alpha female. 06, meanwhile, had 755 by her side, along with hulking 754, his leg now mostly healed, her 2 adult daughters, 776 and Middle Gray, and their brother, Shy Male. Together with her 5 pups, now almost full-grown yearlings, she had 11 wolves of her own. If 06 was ever going to stand and fight, this was the time to do it. Her answer came in the form of a bellicose howl, which the rest of her pack lustily joined. There would be no retreat. When the Mollies heard the challenge, they jumped to their feet and raced down the hill with tails raised, still spread out in a long line like a cavalry charge. The Lamars moved steadily uphill to meet them, spreading out until the rival packs faced each other in 2 almost perfectly matched lines, each advancing on the other. Just before the lines met, however, the Lamars panicked and broke ranks, fleeing in every direction. The charging Mollies were upon them almost immediately. A black Lamar pup was caught and dragged down, and soon 8 snarling wolves were around him in a circle so tight that Lori couldn't see him at all. She had watched wolves kill coyotes in just this way. All you saw from a distance were the raised tails and straining haunches of the attackers, but you could imagine all too easily what was happening at the bottom of the pile. It was usually over in a few seconds. The pup was almost twice the size of a coyote, but he was still in serious trouble. After perhaps a minute, the attackers left the pup lying in the snow and headed off en masse to pursue other Lamars careening through the trees. Lori could hear bark howling coming from all over the ridge as the splintered Lamars ran for their lives. Wolves were everywhere, and it was impossible to follow them all. She couldn't find 06, though she did spot 755 fleeing west at full sprint, trying, it appeared to her, to draw the Molly wolves away from the pups. Unnoticed in the chaos, the downed black pup roused himself and limped off down the slope, heading for the road. Rick tossed his scope into his SUV and rushed from one lot to the next, steering with his left hand and operating his radio with his right, trying to get the best view of the conflict and dreading what he might find when he did. But there were too many trees and too many folds in the ridge swallowing the wolves as they scattered. Eventually, watchers on the opposite side of the divide reported that fleeing Lamars had made it into the valley, unpursued by the invaders. By nightfall, they had managed to count 10 Lamar wolves. Only the black pup was missing. All 10 seemed to be moving well, with no major injuries. It could have been much worse. That night, the pack retreated far to the east, out of the valley and up the Soda Butte Creek drainage. To the watcher's relief, the black pup, bloodied but not seriously injured, eventually joined them in their temporary exile. The Mollies, meanwhile, set about making themselves at home. Rick knew they hunted bison back in the Pelican Valley, but the area was so remote that he had only ever seen them in action in a remarkable video taken many years before. Fearless and unpredictable, bison were the undisputed lords of Yellowstone, roaming the park with impunity, jamming up the snow-plowed roads in winter where the walking was easy.